From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The impeachment inquiry got even more contentious today with some House Republicans walking in on a closed-door hearing that's part of the investigation. This after damning testimony yesterday from the top U.S. diplomat in Ukraine, William Taylor. Taylor said that President Trump made military aid to Ukraine contingent on that country investigating Trump's political rival Joe Biden. Michael McFaul is former U.S. ambassador to Russia under President Obama and joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And first of all, what did you think of Taylor's testimony, at least the part that we've seen, the opening statement? What stood out to you?
Well, first, I want to say in full disclosure that I've known Bill Taylor for 25 years. I found him to be an amazing diplomat in all the different jobs that he had that we interacted with. So I don't pretend to be a neutral observer when reading his testimony, but I found it devastating, mostly because it was so incredibly detailed. And he just tied together all the little dots and I's and cross T's that you would want to connect the quid pro quo, the holding of military aid and the holding of an Oval Office visit in return for the investigation of this company, Burisma, which Hunter Biden, the vice president's son, sits, and the investigation of alleged meddling of Ukrainian individuals in the 2016 election.
Now, the White House press secretary, Stephanie Grisham, released a statement after Taylor's testimony saying today was just more triple hearsay and there was no quid pro quo. What do you make of that?
Well, I'm sorry. I can say I am 6'8". that doesn't mean that I am 6'8". I mean, I find this defense just alarming to, you know, the intelligence of the people reading those statements. It's just clear as day to me. Whether or not the quid pro quo is an impeachable offense, that's another matter. But the notion that they keep going back to there was no trade when the evidence, I think, is just overwhelming. And by the way, that statement also I found to be really revolting. Triple hearsay, number one, but then to call Ambassador Taylor, as I recall, a radical, unelected bureaucrat. This is a person that served our country for 50 years. Democrats and Republicans, by the way, he was appointed U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine by President Bush. I just find this attacking the messenger strategy also indicative that they don't have the facts on their side.
As you know, the acting White House Chief of Staff, Mick Mulvaney, was asked last week about a quid pro quo, and he seemed to say that, yes, there was a quid pro quo, and then he ended up walking that back. But one of the things that he said in that press conference was, we do that all the time with foreign policy. As a former ambassador yourself, did you ever see foreign policy, as he said, become political in any way?
So when I was in the government, I served 5 years in the Obama administration, we did set up quid pro quos. In fact, even with Ukraine, I was involved in some of those where we said there will not be a meeting with President Obama. For instance, we did this in 2010, I believe, with President Yanukovych, unless you do something to secure your nuclear waste, right? That's called diplomacy, tit for tat, leverage. That part is true. What is not true is that I never remember a time when we did a quid pro quo to advance President Obama's personal interests or his reelection efforts. That is the part that's radically, to my knowledge, has never been done before.
Okay, I want to ask you about the other big reason we wanted to talk to you, which is what's going on in Syria. And Russia has started patrolling parts of the Syrian border in a deal reached with Turkey yesterday. Those two countries now working together in northeast Syria after the U.S. pullout. What do you make of that deal and the idea that Russia now has more control in that region?
It's a giant victory for Vladimir Putin. He's been working at this for years. He wants to be the kingmaker in the Middle East. He wanted to support his dictator and ally, Mr. Assad. Now he's achieving the result he wanted, especially with our complete capitulation. So now he's negotiating with Erdogan. The Americans are not even at the table.
Let me ask you one more thing. As you look at Russia right now, how is it possible that a country that has an economy that is less than one-tenth the size of the United States, having so many successes all over the world achieving its goals?
Well, Putin has, you know, small cards in his hands, but he's not afraid to play them. So I think part of it is due to the way that he is not afraid to break the rules of the game. But it partly is also, you know, the Trump administration and President Trump himself. This is capitulation. He's pulling out of our of Syria and giving Putin a win and getting nothing in return. You know, we were earlier talking about tit for tats and quid pro quo. There's none of that kind of setup with respect to Syria. And I would say the same is true in Ukraine. The big loser in all this scandal, the Trump involvement there and the privatization of our foreign policy there for his personal gain, is a weakening of our relationship with President Zelensky and the new government there. That's also a win for Putin.
That is former U.S. Ambassador to Russia Michael McFaul, now director of the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford. Thank you so much for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
A group of Kurds in Nashville, Tennessee, is also closely watching developments in Syria. The city is home to the largest Kurdish community in the country, roughly 15,000 people. Only some of them are from northern Syria. But as Natasha Sinjanovic reports, Nashville's Kurds say they are united in heartbreak, fear, and a sense of betrayal after President Trump withdrew U.S. support in the region.
Kurdish solidarity was front and center at a pregame tribute that Nashville's minor league soccer club held in the city's largest stadium, just days after the withdrawal was announced. The territory of Kurdistan is divided among five nations, including Syria, Turkey, and Iraq. But Kurds in Nashville say their kinship extends beyond borders, including Ismail Kucher, who owns a small restaurant in a two-mile stretch of strip malls known as Little Kurdistan.
Charm is broken the all Kurdish people heart. Broken heart, all Kurdish people, charm.
Trump has broken the heart of all Kurdish people. Kucher says he can't sleep. His mind reels with images of civilians killed in the recent Turkish airstrikes, including a two-month-old baby.
I cry for the children. Why? What children? What are you doing? Like the old people are. It's not right.
Like most Kurds in Nashville, Kucher is from northern Iraq. He worked as a guard for the U.S. Army, and for that, he and his family had to flee in 1996 under a death threat from Saddam Hussein. He was evacuated to the U.S. and has since become a citizen who says he loves his new homeland. But Kucher says he was shocked by the president's decision. He had voted for Trump.
Would you vote for Trump again?
Never. Never I Trump. Would never Trump. Yeah.
Kucher's daughter, Nishtaman, says many in her community believed Trump's campaign trail rhetoric about helping Kurds. She did not.
I never thought America had the Kurds back. Never. I feel like it's a business transaction. Every time that they're over there for their own benefits. I feel like they put it out there like we're helping Kurds, and the Kurds fall for it each time.
But being betrayed by the American government is nothing new, say members of the Salah Adin Center, the mosque in Nashville's Little Kurdistan. Imam Salah Osman is an Iraqi Kurd.
In my life, this is the third time I see it from the United States.
Osman says in the 1970s, and again under President George H.W. Bush, the U.S. first backed, then abandoned the Kurds in armed conflicts in Iraq. Each time, thousands of Kurds died and hundreds of thousands were displaced. The Kurds in Nashville say they're tired of seeing history repeated at their expense.
We sacrifice ourselves to protect the whole world against these devils.
That's what Mehmet, a 31-year-old Turkish Kurd, calls ISIS. He's currently seeking asylum and asked that we not use his last name. He believes that if it weren't for the Kurds, there would have been more ISIS attacks in Europe, the U.S., and elsewhere. He says it's the Kurds' turn to be protected. Mehmet is from Mardin, Turkey, near the city of Kamishla in northern Syria. He says people in the two border cities can practically wave to one another.
When we shake our hand, they saw us. We are that much close.
Kamishla was one of the first sites bombed by Turkey this month. And Mehmet says his family and friends there fear getting caught in the crossfire or becoming direct targets of the Turkish government, which he says is as ruthless as ISIS against the Kurds. So he doesn't blame Kurdish military leaders for forging a tenuous alliance with Syria and the Russians against the Turks. The Kurds will have to give up much of their hard-won territory in northern Syria, but it may avert genocide, Mehmet says.
Okay, we are not dying, maybe. Less people will die. That's good, but still, I think we deserve more.
So does Dilgesh Abrahim, who grew up in Qamishla. The 38-year-old took part in a peace rally earlier this month in downtown Nashville, which drew a crowd of several hundred people. Abrahim fled Syria in 2006 after spending a year in prison, he says, for organizing Kurdish demonstrations against the Syrian government. His immediate family was later relocated, but he says he has friends and relatives who have been killed by Syrian and Turkish forces over the years. He wants to see long-term stability in the region and independence for Kurdistan, which he says will require significant change.
How can we build this country? How can we build peace with others? How can we change our policy? Because what I'm doing now is clearly not working.
It definitely can't work, says Abrahim, if the U.S. gives up the Kurds to Turkey. For Here and Now, I'm Natasha Sinjanovic in Nashville.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
Let's get back to our top stories, the impeachment inquiry and the situation in Syria, and bring in our political strategists.
And joining us today, Yvette Simpson, Democratic strategist. She's in Cincinnati. Hi, Yvette.
Hi there.
And Matt Mikowiak, Republican strategist. He's in Austin. Hi, Matt.
Hey.
We are so outside the Beltway today. I love it.
How about that?
So, Matt, let me start with you. After Bill Taylor's closed-door testimony yesterday, the facts do seem to be lining up that the president asked for help from a foreign government in a U.S. election, which is against the law, and held up military assistance to Ukraine in exchange for that help. Can you defend that as a Republican?
Well, I'd say a couple things. Based on what has been released, all we have is the access to the transcript of his opening statement, right? We don't have access to the Q&A, and I think there have been reports that during the Q&A, he admitted under oath that Ukraine did not know about the delay in foreign aid. So I just think that's a really central question. There's no quid pro quo if the other side doesn't know what part of the deal
is. We do
have
the transcript, though, from that phone call, the partial transcript, that did show President Trump saying he wanted a favor from the head of Ukraine.
Yes. And as you know, and then this has been – there's been confusion about this. The part where he talks about the favor is about 2016. Later part, I think several paragraphs later, he's talking about Burisma in 2020. So look, I do think there's a distinction between 2016 and 2020. I think it's entirely appropriate for the United States government to ask a foreign government to cooperate in an investigation in election meddling in a past election. I think it's totally inappropriate to ask a foreign government to meddle in a future election. Look, I'm not going to, quote, defend anything because at this point we have very, very limited information. We have a transcript of a phone call. We have a few opening statements that have been released. These hearings are being held in secret and no one really knows what's being said under oath under questioning. So I want to learn more. I'm in that category. I don't think this impeachment inquiry is being done in a way that's serious and transparent. And I think the process concerns, which are, yes, just process, are meaningful and do matter. And if the Democrats really want to run a serious impeachment process, they would pass a vote to approve an inquiry and they would open it up and allow the minority to have rights and to let witnesses have due process.
Okay, Yvette, let me let you respond to what Matt said there.
Where do I start, right? So Taylor's testimony was damning. And I think everyone who was in that room talked about the fact that it was damning, not just because this is someone who is decorated, who has been in service for 50 years, someone who Pompeo handpicked, someone who has worked for Republican administration, and he is testifying to key allegations in the whistleblower complaint and is, I think, contradicting Ambassador Sondland's testimony, which I think is so very important. And so there's a question about whether we need to bring Sondland back to actually clarify some of the things that he made in his statement earlier. So it is damning. And I disagree with Matt. I do think that any attempt by our government, our president, to try to get a foreign government to to interfere in any election, past or present, is questionable. I would call it impeachable. I think the Republicans are really grasping at straws now to hold this thing together. So I think once we hear more testimony, we know what's happening today with Secretary Cooper. Once we hear more, I think the facts are going to continue to confirm the original whistleblower complaint. And I think Taylor's testimony was a big moment in the impeachment inquiry. And I'm excited to hear what comes from this.
Well, Matt, you say that you want to learn more, but do you see any cracks in Republican support for the president?
No, not really. I mean, I think there are a couple outliers like Mitt Romney and perhaps a few House members.
And John Thune today, yes.
Yeah, John Thune, plus you obviously had Francis Rooney announced, you know, he was getting more concerned than announced he was not running again. So, look, I think one of the challenges here is whether Democrats want impeachment to be bipartisan, where they even want to make an attempt. And the way you do that is by allowing the minority to have rights so that, that this process could be more transparent. I've got to be honest with you. I feel very limited in the analysis that can be done when the only facts we have are a transcript the White House released and a few opening statements that were released by witnesses. We don't have the Q&A. These hearings are not open to the public. Members of Congress, 90% of members of Congress don't know what's happening inside. So I just think we have a very partial view at this point. And I do think the central question is, did Ukraine know that foreign aid was being withheld and that something was required to get foreign aid released? If they knew that, then you have absolute proof of a quid pro quo. Right now, I don't think we have that.
Well, I would say, first of all, go ahead. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Well, a quid pro quo is not required, right? I mean, we're focusing on the quid pro quo. I think there is certainly evidence that that took place, and I think the evidence will continue to show that. But a quid pro quo is not required. Our president asking a foreign government to interfere in election itself is an impeachable offense. And I think the fact that the Democrats are doing exactly what they're supposed to do. They are not required to take a vote in order to start an impeachment inquiry. I think the Republicans are showing why it's important to have these measures to protect witnesses, to protect the integrity of this process, because they have shown that they will interfere. President Trump himself said he wanted to know the identity of the whistleblower, which I think the way that the Democrats have been conducting this is the best way to conduct it. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. And I think the evidence is coming forward. And I think Republicans are getting very worried and throwing everything they can at this thing to stop or slow down the process.
Yvette, I'd love to know, what do you want the Democrats to do next?
You know, I think what they're doing is smart. I think proceeding with deliberate speed, right, being very careful, bringing in witnesses, protecting the integrity of evidence, because we know that this administration is not going to comply. They're trying to say that if the Democrats take a vote, they will comply. But that's a delay tactic. They have no intention of cooperating with this investigation, with this inquiry. And I think they continue to bring forward the facts. And eventually, more and more of this story will get out to the public. But I think they're doing the right thing and making sure they're bringing people in, corroborating the original whistleblower complaint and making sure that they're focusing on the facts at hand.
Okay, one more thing on this before we move on to Syria, which is, Matt, President Trump compared what's happening to him to a lynching. Mm-hmm. Do you think that that is acceptable?
No, I don't. I mean, we can end it there and save the time. No, I don't. I was interested to see that, I guess, Biden had used a similar phrase previously and has apologized for it. I wish the president would apologize for it. Look, did he mean it in a racial context? I doubt it. He may have. If he did, it's even worse. But we have to be very careful about language we use. And it's not just about what you hear. It's about how people make you feel when you're saying something. That word has obviously very loaded history, given the history of race relations in this country. And it brings up a lot of horrible memories for a lot of people. So there's just no reason to use that word. He can call it a lot of other things. I wish he wouldn't use that word.
OK. I'm assuming that Yvette agrees with that statement.
As an African-American female, yes. Okay. 100% agree.
So let's talk about Syria. President Trump announced this morning that he's lifting sanctions on Turkey that were imposed after that country's military operations in northern Syria earlier this month. Here he is.
Early this morning, the government of Turkey informed my administration that they would be stopping combat and their offensive in Syria and making the ceasefire permanent, and it will indeed be permanent. However, you would also define the word permanent in that part of the world as somewhat questionable. We all understand that, but I do believe it will be permanent.
Matt, this is being described as a victory for Turkey and Russia, the U.S. abandoning its allies, the Kurds. It does seem like Turkey got everything it wanted from this invasion. Did the U.S. get anything?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think the administration needs to explain it better. They need to conduct a briefing with the Senate. I'm disappointed that hasn't happened yet. Look, it's a good thing the temporary ceasefire led to a permanent ceasefire. It's a good thing that we have fewer Americans in danger in that region, in that part of the region. Although I did see they're looking at perhaps locating some troops in western Iraq, and they've sent some troops to Saudi Arabia. So I don't know what the net effect of all that is. I do have long-term concerns about this in terms of what it means for future potential allies if they're going to trust the word of the United States. I obviously have deep concern about the Kurdish militias who've been such patriotic and courageous fighters alongside Americans, taking heavy losses themselves, but really giving much heavier losses to ISIS. And of course, we have concerns about the custodianship of ISIS fighters. So lots of issues there. I did see the president apparently talk to General Mazoum of the Kurdish militia, and apparently it was good and positive call based on the quotes that were put out. Mm-hmm. So we'll see where it goes from here. I still have concerns. I think administration still needs to explain exactly how this happened, why this happened, and what the long-term ramifications are on U.S. national security.
Yeah, lots of folks have concerns. But let's transition to the 2020 election. A CNN poll out today found former Vice President Joe Biden's lead in national polls now stands at its widest margin since April with 34%. Senator Elizabeth Warren ranked second with 19% support, followed by Senator Bernie Sanders at 16%. Yvette, is this a surprise considering Biden's recent struggles?
No. I mean, I think it's a national poll and it's just one data point. You know, there are a lot of polls being conducted. I think the early states, which are going to be much more informative on kind of how this race, which is a very iterative process, will go on, are a little bit more reflective. But at the end of the day, fear is motivating this election. A lot of people still really worried about taking Trump out. I think a lot of people still feel like Biden is a safe choice, despite the fact that, his campaign is failed. His debate performance is challenged. I think looking at Iowa, looking at New Hampshire, the early states, which will be approaching in the next few months, are a little bit more indicative. So not surprised. I really believe, though, that when you think about the way that Democratic insiders, mainstream corporate Democrats have been framing this election, I think it's challenging going forward when you think about the fact that putting all of your eggs in the Biden basket when we know all the challenges that he presents is problematic. I think going forward, you're going to continue to see kind of the progressive movement continue to motivate more of those competitors taking center stage. And that's what we're seeing in the early
states. And we've got just about 3 months until Iowa. Yvette Simpson, Democratic strategist, and Matt Mikowiak, Republican strategist. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
We are living in the dawn of a new era in computing. Today, Google researchers officially announced that their supercomputer, Sycamore, has reached quantum supremacy. And it's not science fiction. Yes, you heard a reference to Quantum Leap there. Quantum supremacy is actually the ability to do calculations at speeds that were once unimaginable. So to help us make sense of all of this, we're joined by Yale University Professor of Physics, Stephen Gervin. Welcome, Stephen.
Thank you, Tanya. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, so I gave a quick layperson's definition of quantum supremacy, but what does this actually mean?
Quantum supremacy is using a quantum computer, a new type of computer, carry out some task, not necessarily a useful task, but carry it out faster than could be done with an ordinary or what we call classical computer.
So we have heard that it's been described as a physiological leap, accepting that a single object can behave like two separate objects at the same time. Can you parse that out for us a bit?
Sure. So one of the principles of quantum mechanics is that particles can act like waves. Their position can be spread out and be uncertain. A computer built on quantum principles has states for its bits that are 0 and 1, just like an ordinary computer, but they can actually be in a superposition of both possibilities at the same time. And that allows a quantum computer to sort of do many things at the same time, and therefore solve certain types of problems exponentially faster than an ordinary classical computer can.
Can you tell me what calculation this new supercomputer, Sycamore, processed, what it actually did?
It involves a kind of random number generation that, you know, you want to generate a random number, which is, let's say, you're the lottery commission and you want to generate the winning number and keep it secret. That's actually a complicated task. This quantum machine is generating a sequence of random numbers that have some true randomness in them.
Okay, and you mentioned that there are so many people who are working on this. IBM, one of Google's competitors in the race to break through quantum computing, yes, there is a race, claims that there isn't quite the breakthrough that Google is claiming and that, in fact, other computers could process this calculation as well. Is that true?
I think there's a general feeling that with a bit more effort in thinking about how to do the classical calculation that Google did on their quantum machine, it would not take as long as they suggested in their paper. And IBM has already says that instead of taking thousands of years, the same calculation might be doable in a couple of days.
So many questions, but excitement for the future of technology. That's Yale University Professor of Physics, Stephen Gervin. Thank you so much, Stephen.
Thank you, Tanya.
Suicide attempts by black teens are increasing. They're up 73% since 1991, while rates for other young people, including white teenagers, fell slightly or remained unchanged over the same period. That's according to data published this month in the journal Pediatrics. And for more, we're joined by Sean Joe, one of the study's authors. He's a professor of social work at Washington University in St. Louis. Dr. Joe, what are the reasons behind this increase?
Well, there's several things we got to consider. As always, you have to consider that the lived experience of young black children has now come to a point where they're considering suicidal behavior when threatened with high levels of hopelessness, increased stigma around mental health issues, lack of access to effective mental health care, and concerns just about everyday adolescent experiences. So for black girls in particular, I'm concerned with this study where we're finding an increase in suicide attempts for black girls because they often have strong social networks to connect with that black boys didn't have. So we understood why black boys were increasing their suicidal behavior, but black girls is even more troubling. So that suggests to me that there's potentially more increased trauma in this population that's not dealt with, greater level of a hopelessness that might be ensuing for this population that we have never seen before. So these are things we must really take a look at.
Well, when you talk about increased stigma, are you saying that there is an increased stigma for getting help for mental health in the black community? There's an increased stigma there?
Yes, because again, we're looking at this over time that access to mental health care, seeking mental health care, I'm concerned whether or not there's an increased stigma around just being diagnosed with a mental illness, though more of our young people are familiar with mental illness, but more important, reaching out and actually receiving services for mental illness and to be known for receiving services for mental illness. So I was just concerned about that. But I don't think that's the major driver. I think it's going to really be more about the trauma and somehow a reduction in the social support network that black girls usually access. And we have to take a look at that.
And why would there be such a reduction in the social support that black girls usually access?
This is where we have to have more science to take a closer look at. For instance, are black young girls less likely now to be engaged in the black church when before they really were avid goers, avid churchgoers, and participation in organized religious activities. So I'm concerned about whether or not that's having an impact. The other thing we have to look at is whether or not there's increasing in any notions of bullying among young Black girls, and whether or not those normal social networks of kind girls being now impacted by mean girls that might reduce their access to social support that girls usually have in their lives, particularly young Black girls. So paying attention to these patterns and trends allows us to really take a look at what might result from increasing rates of suicides. Because remember, attempts come before dying by suicide. So we look at these things to be able to project out, are we going to see increased rates in actual suicide deaths among Black youth over time?
Well, and are there warning signs that people should look for before the attempts even happen?
Oh, definitely. We have to pay attention to whether or not our young people are starting to turn away from things that they usually like. They stop engaging in activities. They start making statements akin to, I don't feel like I want to be here. It might be too much for me to be here. I might be a burden to you. We want to listen to these sort of statements very carefully and realize that our young people are trying to signal that they are not okay. Also, if they express direct interest in suicidal behavior, we have to pay attention to that. So look at what they're doing behaviorally. Are they shying away from activities that they typically like? Are they not starting to eat, starting to isolate themselves? But also listen to the words and how they communicate, how they're feeling and how they're experiencing life at this time.
Dr. Joe, at the risk of getting too graphic for our listeners, I do want to ask you, how are people so young, and we're talking here about people as young as the age of five, through their teens, how are they trying to do this? Is it using a gun? Is it cutting themselves? What are the methods that you're seeing?
Sure, and this is a very important question. For children, those under 12, when they die by suicide, the method, most common method, is some form of asphyxiation. But once you get into the older teens, early teens and older teens, then a firearm become more of the prevalent method used by Black adolescents.
And so does that bring gun control into the equation as you think about solutions to the suicide crisis among Black youths?
It does bring firearm access into the equation, because we have to ask, how are these young Black males having access to these firearms that results in death when they have a very impulsive suicidal thought or experiencing a suicidal crisis? And for us, we know that in states where you have more restrictive access to firearms, with greater provisions to understand people's mental health, understand their risk to themselves and others, in those states, you see a 20% to 33% difference in the rates of suicide than in states where you do not.
So in terms of other solutions, what have you found works when it comes to preventing suicide among Black youth and teenagers?
Well, this is the big challenge, because one of the key things, and I've been in this field for a long time, and this is really an equity issue, that we really don't have studies that have focused on ethnic minority populations to really test whether or not cognitive behavioral therapy and other measures that's been shown to reduce suicide risk, and one or two that is shown to reduce suicides in the population. We have not tested those things for Black populations. So we are at a loss to say what really works. But at best, we know that it's important to screen for suicidal behavior. We know it's important to try to engage our Black children in mental health services. But do we have definitive evidence? We do not. And again, I've been doing this for well over 15 years, and we have not seen significant investments in any study that's really focused on these populations, despite the rise over time in suicide among this group.
Another group, as you know, that has a higher suicide rate than the average is LGBTQ youth. Do you think there's a connection between those two groups that are in the minority in the country?
Well, the literature is fairly clear that given the sort of developmental experience many young LGBT youth experience, that they're at higher risk for the factors that increase their chances of engaging in suicidal behavior. So, yes, I do think we have to pay attention to that. I just think for many Americans, they're experiencing great sense of despair. And I think that's not only impacting the adults. We saw a rise in suicide. Like, we haven't had rates of suicides for this nation this high since World War II. Hmm. And we've seen significant increase in suicide among men, poor and rural white males. We've seen increase in suicide among women, white women in particular, and we've seen increases in suicide among our children. There's just so much of a sense of despair. I don't think it's in isolation that black children are having these experiences. When we used to average roughly about, when I began in this work, maybe about 30,000 suicides a year, now we're well into 50,000 plus suicides a year. So that just told me that things are getting worse. Put in context, suicide is still fairly rare, but you're talking about 50,000 people a year who are dying from an illness that is potentially and really preventable because they're experiencing such despair in this country.
But you think young, old, black, white, the core reason for somebody to attempt suicide is just a general sense of despair?
Well, it's a sense of despair that leads to pain, and people have a sense of hopelessness that there is nothing they can perceive at this time because of either mental illness, complicated by mental illness or substance use, that their life is going to get better. But we know that for those whom we do get help or even talk therapy in combination with pharmaceutical treatment, particularly for white populations, we know that life does get better. And these suicidal moments usually last about 10 minutes. So we can intervene and prevent them. That's why we think it's preventable, because they don't last. They're cyclical. So there's opportunities for us to intervene. We do think you can make a difference. But again, you have to give people a real sense of hope and allow them to live more purposeful lives in this country.
That is Sean Joe, whose new study on black youth suicide, we will post it here and now.org. He's a professor of social work at Washington University in St. Louis. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And by the way, as we say when we talk about suicide on the program, if you feel you're in a crisis, please call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255 or text HOME to 741-741 for the crisis text line.
Back in August, we told you about how, thanks to advancements in technology, Qantas was testing flights from New York and London to Australia with flight times lasting 19 hours. That flight likely won't be available until 2023. But travelers in the U.S. will soon be able to fly direct to destinations throughout the continent of Africa. For some airlines, it's the first time in decades they're offering flights to places like Cape Town and Casablanca. And the reasons have as much to do with technology as they do with demand. For more, let's bring in Seth Kaplan, Here and Now's transportation analyst. Hey, Seth.
Hey, Tanya.
So it used to be that flying from the U.S. to Africa meant 30 or even 40 hours one way. With these long layovers in London or Amsterdam, tell us about some of these new shorter routes.
Yeah, just to take a few, you mentioned Cape Town and Casablanca. United introducing nonstop flights from Newark all the way to Cape Town. Casablanca, a couple new routes. American, Philadelphia to Casablanca. And Royal Air Maroc over in Morocco, the national airline there, flying from Casablanca to Miami. So it's airlines from both sides that are trying some of these new routes.
Okay, and why are they now offering these new direct flights from Africa now?
Well, a combination of rising demand in some markets, just markets maturing, them feeling like they can profitably operate a flight. But then part of the reason why they feel they can profitably operate a flight is that now they have the airplanes that can do it. And for a long time, you would have been able to technically fly a plane these distances, but it just wouldn't have been efficient back when you had to fly a really big four-engine airplane, like a 747, let's say, in those markets, burning a lot of fuel and then just with a whole lot of seats to fill. So some of these smaller, more efficient planes where airlines say, you know what, I don't have to fill 400 or 500 seats anymore. I just have to fill 250 and I can do it rather efficiently. Those can make all the difference.
Yeah, on the demand side, though, it's worth noting that Africans are now the fastest growing immigrant group in the United States. Could that have something to do with these routes opening up as well, that demand?
Yeah, that's always a big part of travel demand. When you think about what drives travel, really three big categories: leisure demand, people going on vacations; business demand, people going to meetings or conferences; and then what you call VFR, or visiting friends and relatives, migrant That's traffic. Right. And absolutely, as the African diaspora grows, no surprise to see flights connecting the places where people end up with the places where they're from and where their families still are.
Yeah, and we know that 3 years ago, United offered a direct route from Houston to Nigeria for folks on business in the oil industry, but that route was discontinued. And you mentioned these planes, so not just to Africa, but all around the world these days, the Boeing 787-9. You talked a little bit about fuel efficiency, but what else is special about this plane?
Yeah, also known as the Dreamliner. This has really changed things because of how far it can fly, but on just two engines and with not so many seats to fill. These African routes are perfect examples. But, when British Airways first started flying from London to Austin, Texas several years ago, they did it with one of these planes for the same reason. One of those routes that you might not have been able to imagine in the old days, even though you somehow could have done it, but you couldn't have made money doing it. These planes very much making the difference here.
On another note, switching gears a little bit, on the 737 MAX, we should mention that the head of Boeing's commercial airplane unit, Kevin McAllister, he's leaving the company, which is good or bad news for Boeing. I'd like to know your thoughts.
Well, Boeing clearly felt that at this point, with people sort of noting that despite all that has happened, the 346 deaths and all of the recent revelations about what Boeing might have known and when, nobody at any significant level had lost their job because of this. And so this could be just sort of Boeing offering somebody up as a sacrifice, basically. Kevin McAllister first joined Boeing in late 2016, so he wasn't there for the development of the MAX and some of the mistakes that seem to have been made for that, but he certainly was there for the response. And with even the FAA, which had been accused of kind of being too cozy with Boeing, now seemingly growing impatient with Boeing, maybe Boeing just felt that it had to make a move like this.
Yeah, had to make a move. And what's the latest? How are they weathering all of this with the few seconds that we have?
Well, the question is how long of a term this issue will be. This is a company that's clearly suffering. Now, look, on one hand, it is half of a powerful duopoly. There are two major aircraft manufacturers, and a lot of these airlines are going to want to continue to rely on Boeing. But they have time and again proven to be too optimistic about how soon they'd be able to move forward.
So there's definitely a lot there. Yes. Thank you so much, Seth Kaplan. Here and Now's transportation analyst. It's Here and Now.